then I'd ask you to please help me welcome Teresa C. from Santa Barbara as our speaker tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Teresa. I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to be here. It's good to be sober. What a nice group of people. Thank you, everybody, for welcoming me and making me feel at home. And thank you, Lee, for inviting me tonight. And thank you for everybody who brought food. You know, it's everybody has to participate. And, you know, without everybody doing a little bit of something, we wouldn't have a meeting, right? So thank you, everybody. And welcome to the newcomers. Gosh, I remember when I had 90 days. Oh, I don't want to go there again. So, you know, when I was new, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. So I got sober in the Pacific Group, this big meeting in LA. Wednesday night, there's like 1,200 people at the time. It's the biggest meeting that meets on a regular basis in the world. So here I am, 90 days, and I don't like people. And I'm standing in the back room, you know, 90 days. So the Pacific Group is very active, lots of commitments. You know, for some reason, I got to sponsor my first meeting. Well, not my first meeting, but I met this woman. Anyway, I don't want to talk about that right now. Anyway, so at the meeting Wednesday night, and I have a few friends, you know, I go to a meeting almost every day. And so I have a few friends after 90 days and, you know, my age group. And I'm standing in the back of this meeting going, oh my God, why am I here? There are all these people. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be sober. I don't even know if I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just standing there crying. And then my friends that I had at that point said, somebody go find her sponsor. So somebody went and got my sponsor. And she's like, I think it's time for the third step. And, you know, that's what my sponsors all along have been. It's the steps of the solution to everything. And I'm like, what? How? What? That makes no sense. And so my first meeting was March 5th, 1983. I have 36 years and some months. And my first meeting, there was like 450 people there. And I walked in and everybody was supposedly sober. I'm like, real? Okay, whatever. I didn't believe it. No. And why? Why are you even here? Just, you know, I went as a visitor. I was just with him. You know, my cocaine connection got sober. And anyway, he thought I should go. So anyway, I was there, and I heard my first speaker that night was Dr. Paul, and he's in the Big Book. Of course, I didn't know that, and I just remember him talking about his wife committed him to the insane asylum, and he made these little moccasins because he couldn't quite get the hang of the belt. So they said, here, make these shoes. So he made these little moccasins. And his wife bronzed them and put them on the mantle when he got out of the nut house. And I remember laughing at that. And I thought, wow, that's so funny. And then I had the conscious thought was, wow, I'm laughing and I'm not loaded. You know, and so like all these little things, I thought, well, maybe I am an alcoholic. Maybe I should stay. I don't know. And at some point, I don't know if I had 30, 60, 90 days. I don't know how much time I had. But I said, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not, but I'm going to stay here and find out if I am. And that was over 36 years ago, and I've not gone out. I mean, I stayed, and I've always been active, you know. I hear people take breaks, oh, I took 5 years off, whatever. No, how do you do that? I could never take a break from AA. For some odd reason, don't go to a meeting for a week, I'm like crazy. And everybody starts acting weird, you know. Everybody starts acting strange. But, you know, I go to meetings by myself a lot. Like, I'll travel somewhere to speak by myself. I have no problem going by myself. But to this day, I've never been to a movie by myself because, like, people think I have no friends, you know? But I can come, I can travel and go anywhere to an AA meeting because you're my people, you know? We're here, like, it talks in the Big Book about we're a common bond and, you know, it's like we're passengers of a sinking ship. And we're here for each other, and I really appreciate how welcome you guys made me feel when I came in, so thank you so much. The little 24-hour day book, the little Hazleton thing, I think it is, says somewhere on May 30th, it says something like, Alcoholics Anonymous is human in its organization, but divine in its purpose. And its purpose is to point me toward God and a better life. And to say I have a better life than what I had before would be a gross understatement. To go from where I was to where I am, it's just nothing short of miraculous. And, you know, I owe everything in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing I've ever done in my whole life. And, you know, I'm getting older, and I have a handful of really good, close friends that are sober. And these days, I make it a point to tell them how much I love them, you know, because actually on my way up here, I just got to share this quickly, but my mother-in-law, my ex-mother-in-law, but she's still my mother-in-law, is She went to hospice a couple days ago, and on my way up, my daughter called and said the doctors told her and my husband that she's probably going to die within the hour. And so she's probably passed now, you know. But, you know, in the back of my mind, it's like, turn around and go home. Turn around and go to the hospital, go to the hospice, you know. But, you know, I made a commitment, and here I am. And she has family there, so it's not like she's alone. So, you know, no matter what happens in my life, I always put AA first. And I think that's how I'm able to stay here as long as I have, you know. Yeah, okay, the playoff games are on, you know, these in the 80s. Remember the Celtics and the Lakers? But, you know, when the playoff games were on, I didn't miss a meeting. I went to my meeting, and, you know, if I have to leave at halftime, I have to go at halftime. You know, it's just as simple as that. But nowadays, we have DVRs, yay! So I can watch it anytime. It's just a bummer if you hear the score. So anyway, yeah, I shuddered to think where my life would be. My mother is happy I'm sober. My mother for years would say, Teresa, you're an alcoholic. I'm like, oh my God, no, I'm not. And, you know, the thought of not drinking in those days, I started drinking at 13 and did my first hit of LSD at 13, smoked weed, everything, 13. And I'm going to this little Catholic high school in Massachusetts where I'm from, and Worcester, Massachusetts. It's the third largest city in the state. And I know nobody's ever heard of it, but it has third largest state, city. You know, this Catholic school girl, here I am, we're uniformed, you know, from kindergarten to the 12th grade Catholic school. And we had religion every day. You know, by the 12th grade, you think, what? What's new? You know, nothing. So anyway, so here I am, this little Catholic girl, you know, dropping acid in school, you know. And the nuns knew I had nuns, and we would drink, we'd go out and smoke weed in the car at lunch. You know, it was just a big party school. The public school used to come over to my school for the stuff, you know. And I really wanted to go to public school because I was just tired of it, you know, tired of the same people. I mean, it was the same people from kindergarten to the 12th grade. And you would have thought I was comfortable with these kids, but no, wasn't, because I'm an alcoholic. And I'm self-centered, just all about me all the time. And what are you thinking? It was hard for me to have a conversation because I was always so worried about what you were thinking of me. How's my mascara? How's my hair look? You know, and then so it was like my turn to talk, and I couldn't reply because I wasn't listening because I was thinking about me. And so I didn't, wait, what did you say? You know, so it was dumb. And so as a result of that, I didn't talk much. You know, I was really shy, really introverted. I was afraid to talk, or I thought you would laugh at me, you know, because what I would say back or whatever. But so very shy, very introverted. And so when I took that first drink at 13, I'm like, wow, this is great. Instant perception change. I liked me. I liked you. People weren't so bad because I mean, kindergarten, I wish I drank because all those little kids were there. I didn't like them, you know? And so I'm like, wow, this is great. And I thought, my second thought was, no wonder Dad drinks. My dad was a daily drinker and a gambler. And my brother shared up in Santa Barbara. My brother's also sober. I don't want to leave him out there drunk. I do sometimes, but he's sober. He came in 2 years after I did. And he was sharing about, which I hadn't thought of in years, but we used to gamble on everything in my house, Parcheesi, checkers, you know. And my brother, we had this little game called Skittle Bowl where with these pins on a thing, and it was just a ball suspended from a pole, and you'd swing the ball around, come back and strike the pins, you know. My brother and I would play for hours before my father would come home, and then we'd bet for like $5 a game. We were like 10, 8, 9 years old, 10 years old. And he'd get so mad, he'd throw the thing. But anyway, so we were gamblers too at an early age, it was just so much fun. And so my brother was right along with me, you know. My brother was kind of a bad alcoholic too. So so here we are, we're in high school, and it's time for the yearbook, you know, like. And the nuns hated our class because we were a bunch of drunks and, you know, everybody's stoned all the time, and they hated us. We made them cry. Well, like the boys did. It wasn't me. And so they hated us. So we didn't really even have a yearbook. It was really like construction paper stapled together with pictures on it from magazines. I just remember on mine there was somebody glued a picture of a horse on it and pack of Marlboros, you know, and that was it. I mean, I don't remember. If there were yearbooks, I don't have one. And no pictures or anything. I don't know, weird. So what I got in that, you know how you get best dressed or whatever? I'm like, oh yeah, I'll get best dressed, but like we wore uniforms, so what does that do? I don't know. So I remember I was telling my mother this the other day. For some reason, we're standing in my kitchen. I'm telling her the story that, isn't it weird that I got most popular, my brother got most popular boy. And it's no big feat, trust me. I mean, there's a 50 in my graduating class, you know, it wasn't that big a deal. And nobody was more surprised than me that I got most popular because I thought I had no friends. You know, my perception of reality was so askew, and I thought I had no friends, and so I get that, my brother gets that. And my mom's like, you thought you had no friends? And she starts rattling off all these my best friends, like Janice and Ellen and Trisha, and you know. I'm like, yeah, I know, Ma, but it seemed like, nobody liked me. It seemed like I had no friends, but it's so. So then when I started drinking, and then, you know, then I thought they were my friends, but I always had to have something in me. Anyway, and so this is kind of a weird thing. Talk about perception. It seemed to me like in junior high, everybody had boyfriends and girlfriends and stuff, and I didn't. And I thought, why don't I have a boyfriend? I'm like 12, you know. Why don't I have a boyfriend? And, you know, I was skinny. I had glasses, braces. Maybe that's why. I don't know. But so I thought it was because I had no boobs. I was flat-chested at the time. And so I was out shoplifting one day, and I stole this Nerf football. So I had this bright idea. I'm going to cut the ends off and put it in my bra. So I went from, like, an A cup to a double D overnight. And everybody's like, and they're all asking my brother, hey, Bob, what's up with your sister? And he's all, I don't know. So I'm like, oh, my God, they're too big. So I went home, and I started cutting them and whittled them down, made them smaller. And then everybody noticed that. I'm like, oh, my God, give me a drink. I needed a drink so bad. And so, oh, my God, if the internet, I mean, you know, I just wanted to die. It's one of those I want to die moments when you're 12, 13 years old. And thank God the internet wasn't around, man. I would have really, you know, curtains. So, yeah, so to go from that, and then people still liked me by the time I graduated from high school. I was astonished. So then I thought, why is that? And I go, oh, because I was dealing drugs one time. Well, but I thought I was, but I really wasn't. I ate most of it. There was speed, you know, I bought, I don't know, 1,000 little, those crossroad things, the little speed things. And I ate most of them, but I used to take handfuls and try to eat them and, you know, get a drink from the fountain, the water fountain, and all bubbling in my mouth and stuff, so nasty. But, I just couldn't figure it out because why, you know, why don't, I don't know why people liked me. But anyway, so I get out of high school and I go to the little community college down, you know, in Worcester. And I graduated in 2 years. I got my associate's in science degree in 2 years. And I went to class, you know, because I guess from my structure at St. Mary's, where you had to go to class, the classes were so small, the nuns would have known if you weren't in class, so you had to always go. But, you know, I used to drink cough syrup, you know, that Robitussin DM went in the olden days when it was good. And I would totally not know if I was in that class or not because it's complete blackout. And I thought, well, I had to be there because you have to go. And I must have been there, but I just had no memory of it. Oh, yeah, and I was a blackout drinker, too. But so I go to this community college, graduate in 2 years, and I got a job at the college that I was working at, working for the director of community services. And it was a really fun job. But, oh, my God, I was just so paranoid and full of fear and anxiety all the time. You know, and it was a college, so these kids would come in and register for classes and stuff like that for the evening division, and my boss did these seminars and things and workshops for kids and parents and stuff, you know, so I was kind of organizing that, and I was like, oh my God, these people, I'm just so scared all the time, you know, and I didn't even realize that, I don't know why I'm talking about this, but so my mother worked down the street, and I would go meet her for lunch sometime, and so there I met him. And him and I dated for, I don't know, a couple weeks or something, and we ended up getting married. And his mother cried. My mother's all, what the F? And, you know, because she didn't like him. She knew him, you know, because she worked with him. She was like, oh, my God. So anyway, we got married. It was a nice wedding. I mean, you know, I guess, yeah, my mother-in-law at the time made my dress, and My father got a horse and carriage, and we rode away from the church in the horse and carriage and went off to take our pictures at the park. You know, it was lovely, I think. I left before I saw the pictures. What happened was, at the wedding, at the reception, and I don't know what happened. Maybe I had a couple DUIs by now. I don't really remember so much. But I just told myself, okay, I'm not drinking at the reception, at my own wedding reception. I'm not going to drink. And I don't know why I was telling myself that. I'm going to just have one. And so I went, you know, got some money, I guess, from the person. I go to pay the bartender, and he goes, oh, it's free for the bride. That was kind of the last thing I remember. Yeah, I don't know how I got home. I'm sure I didn't drive. So, you know, yeah, blackout drinker. And, you know, I just never correlated anything, never correlated the DUIs or anything with drinking. And it was just, you know, a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings. I never thought that my drinking was out of control or, you know, later on I would want to, you know, by the time I came to AA, I was arrested 6 times, 4 DUIs, 1 for drugs and 1 for something else. I don't know what. Oh, they took me out of my, the cops took me out of my own apartment for my own protection because I was like tripping and stuff. So anyway, it was just really just bad luck. And before I would go out, I would have to drink. If I was going to a bar, I would go to bars by myself. And before I would go out, I'd have to drink because it was so hard to walk into the bar straight, you know? So occasionally I would, and I just like, I couldn't wait to drink. Don't make eye contact, I would think, you know, don't look at anybody. And so I had to get a couple of beers and it was good. And then I tried some controlled drinking at some point. You know, I don't know why. I just thought, I don't know why I was trying, controlled drinking this one time. One time I tried, I remember. And I was going to have just 1 beer per hour. And I had 1 beer the first hour. And I'm like, man, that was really freaking hot. So I lasted an hour and that was it. I never tried that again. That was a bad experiment. I had a bet with my brother once, and he said, I bet you can't quit drinking for 30 days. And I said, okay, let's bet. But, you know, drugs were still okay. You could still smoke weed and do acid or whatever, but just no drinking. Okay. So I made it to, like, 25 days, and we were so impressed with each, you know, he's like, wow, you have 25 days, no drinking. God, you can drink now. And just, I don't have to go the 30 days. And I won the bet. So, but yeah, I don't know why we did that either. So, yeah, let's see. Here's a funny story. I think it's funny now, but it wasn't at the time. Divorced that person because he was violent. 2 weeks after we were married, he got a little physically violent. I'm like, wow, that was weird. We should probably go see a counselor or something. He goes, yeah, okay, but we didn't go. So then 2 weeks after that, same thing happened. I'm like, oh, geez, that was weird. You know, it was no broken bones or anything, just strangled me a little bit. And I'm like, wow, that was weird. We should probably go see somebody. He goes, yeah, we should, but we didn't go. So the third time, it was New Year's Eve. I was married in October, I remember, because it was around Halloween. And so I left for the third and last time on New Year's Eve. So all that money my parents spent on the wedding and the la la la. And so I said, like I said, I left before I didn't even see my wedding pictures. That's not funny, I know, sorry. My parents didn't think it was funny. But my mother was happy that I was out of the marriage because she didn't like him, like I said. So anyway, this third time I saw it, you know, I saw the look in his eyes, it's coming. And you know what? I really wanted to kill myself at this point. I was sad, depressed, drinking a lot, still working at the community college. I think he was crazy, really. I didn't know it. I mean, I didn't know him enough to know that before I married him because it was just like so quick. Oh, and why I got married, again, my perception was because I thought everybody from high school is already married when in fact maybe 2 people had gotten married. But I thought I better hurry up and get married and have kids and stuff. But, you know, because I thought I was getting left behind and I was like 21 years old, you know. And because, you know, I look at my mother, she had kids by the time she was 18. She had 2 kids by the time she was 19. So I thought, yeah, boy, I better get on it. But, you know, anyway, it didn't work out with him. And I forgot where I was going, but anyway, left that marriage. Oh, yeah, and I moved back home with my mother, and she wanted me to pay rent. What? And we had this kind of cool lake house. My uncle had the house, and she had the basement apartment. It was all finished and stuff with a plate glass window overlooking the lake, you know, this big sprawling lawn overlooking the lake. And so it was a two-bedroom, so I moved in. And she wanted me to pay $100 a month for rent. Like, $100? It's kind of steep. So I started looking for my own place, and I moved out. And I got an apartment closer to the college that I worked at. So I soon learned it was a little bit more than $100 a month to support myself and pay rent. But it was good, you know. At this point, a couple of my cousins and I, we decided we're going to go see a concert. And I don't know if it was in Rhode Island or Connecticut or someplace, but, you know, someplace woodsy. Everything's kind of woodsy, so there's a city and then woods, and there's a city and woods, you know. And so we go, and, you know, we got beer, and we got our pot, and, you know, but it kind of felt like tripping. So we're at the concert. I don't know who it was. Yes, maybe, or The Who, somebody like that. And so I'm looking around, you know, got any acid, just asking random people, you know, right? Didn't you do that? So I found some, and the concert was half over, and so I ate two hits, because that's what I do, and so, you know, it's time to go home, and I'm, like, really tripping, I can't really see very well, and I asked one of my cousins, they're like, so I'm, like, 21-ish, and they're, like, 18-ish, maybe, 19, and I asked, this is the first time I ever asked anybody if they could drive, because normally I'm good, you know, I'm good, I can drive, even though I'm driving over curbs and, you know, bumper cars and stuff, but I knew I couldn't drive, and they're like, no way, you know, because they were all drunk too, and they're like, no way, well, maybe just get us out of the parking lot, and they'll take it from there, and I'm like, get us out of the parking lot, that's the hard part, and I thought we were moving, I hadn't even turned the car on yet. So I'm like, okay, nobody's dry, I guess it's me, so off we go, and I had no idea where we were, no idea. I'm just driving, it's woods, and I don't know, what I saw a rock that looked familiar or something, and I thought I knew where I was. And I'm like, hey, I think I know where we are, and they're like, yay. So the next thing I know, I see the lights, the police lights. I'm like, oh no, it's the cops, so we pull over, and you know, we open the window and open the car doors, and beer cans are falling out, and smoke's coming out, and we all got arrested, and, you know, it was back in the days, they were going to let us all go, but none of my cousins had a license with them. They were going to actually let us go and let one of my cousins drive, but nobody had let us go. So here comes Aunt Carol and Aunt Deanne, and my father, this is my second DUI, I think, so I said, oh, I called Mom the first time, I'll call Dad this time, you know, give him a turn. And it was one of those demoralizing situations. And I'm like, man, I got to get out of here, you know, and I wanted to move to L.A. anyways. I always wanted to move to California. So, but I couldn't go now because I think I already had a ticket. And I couldn't go now because I have to go to those stupid alcohol education classes and it was like somewhere on the Brookfields way far away from where I live because, you know, we went there, their concerts there. I had to drive there every week and stuff. It was just a big hassle. So, but anyway, I did it. And I always made sure, is it going to be a test on this stuff? No? Okay. So I don't have to pay attention. You know, I just, no good. Did me no good. So anyway, finished that up, and then I moved to L.A. I always wanted to move to California. Oh, why? Because of Haight-Ashbury. But my cousin lived in Hollywood, and my cousin had a friend who lived in Hollywood, so I ended up moving to Hollywood. And it was everything I hoped it would be. You know, a little town in Massachusetts, although it's the third largest city in the state, it was still a small town. And so I moved to L.A., and it was just everything I hoped it would be. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know. And just crazy, more craziness. And out of what happened there was, I got a job in a law firm, and it was on the job training, which is the best, I think. So anyway, I'm working at this law firm, and it was like a double life, you know. I was like normal in the law firm during the day, and then just crazy drinking at night. And I'm, you know, started missing work on Monday, started missing work on Friday, you know. It's like, oh, Friday's the weekend, right? So, and I just, my boss would bring clients in, you know, and it was like I'm still full of fear and anxiety because I didn't really drink at work, you know, and so I'm full of fear and anxiety all the time. And so my boss would come by with a client, and I just want to hide under my desk. You know, I'm like, please don't introduce me, I don't want, you know. And just hated it. I just, my life was just crazy, and I didn't like it. I didn't like me, I didn't like my life. One time I was at the beach, and you know, there were a lot of cops around. So anyway, me and a couple of people went to my house, and we're just partying there. And that was the night that the cops came and took me out of my own apartment for my own protection. I guess the music was up too loud, and somebody was yelling. Maybe it might have been me. And the cops said, "What's going on?" "Nothing," you know. And so they left. So the cops were like, "Okay." They looked around. You know, we managed to throw the pot behind the curtain, and they saw the vodka bottle on the counter. I guess they were satisfied. Everything was good, so they're going to leave. And when they were leaving to go, I felt like Linda Blair in The Exorcist, like I was being possessed by the devil. I thought the people that were in my apartment were the devil. And I called the cops back. I said, "Wait, come back. These guys are the devil. Get a court reporter in here and take down their testimony and ask them what they do for a living." They're like, "What?" So the next thing I know, I was hogtied and carried out of my apartment, put me in a padded cell overnight for my own protection. And I don't see a problem. I still think, well, I'm good. You know, I don't think I have an alcohol drug problem. Not at all. I'm good. So I was hanging around Venice Beach a lot, and that's where I met my cocaine connection. And that's the guy who got sober. And, let me back up for a second. So 2 weeks after this bad trip that I had, I remember telling the cops, I'm like, "Can I just call my mother? Please, can I use the phone to call my mother?" They're like, "No." I'm hogtied in my living room. They won't let me use the phone. So I just knew if I talked to my mother, I'd be okay for some reason. So while I was tripping, who knows what you think. So 2 weeks after that, I'm having a flashback. I'm one of the same persons there in the house, and I'm like having a flashback. And I'm like, "Okay, I can call my mother now." So I ran, I said, "Mom, the devil's here. You have to help me." And she's like, "Huh?" You know, she's in Massachusetts, I'm in LA. So, wait, hold on. And I ran into my bedroom, and I picked up the Bible, and I picked up the extension in the bedroom. I said, "Oh, Mom, I'm safe. I have the Bible now, thanks." And I hung up. So soon after that, she moved to California. She packed up her little French poodle and a trailer and drove 3,000 miles by herself to take care of her 22-year-old daughter. And now I'm getting fired from jobs, you know. So after the padded cell, I went to my Century City law firm job. And I think my boss is the devil. You know, I'm still tripping, still high. I'm like, I gotta go. And I went, and I, you know, it was so real with the possession thing that I went on my way home. I went to stopped at a Catholic church and went and talked to a priest and told him about this, the devil thing. And the priest is all, you know, he's never seen me before. I had no idea, you know. And he's like, "Well, were you on drugs at the time?" I said, "Well, yeah, but that doesn't matter." And he's like, "Maybe you want to stop doing the drugs." I'm like, "Oh, what do you know?" And I left. You know, just completely like, what? Who? Ugh. So anyway, yeah, so now my mother and I got a place. Whee! Woohoo! And now she's telling me, you know, she sees what's going on. She's like, "Teresa, you're an alcoholic." I'm like, "Oh my God, who asked you to move out here anyway? Why don't you go back to Massachusetts where you came from? Leave me alone." Right, the alcoholic mantra, just leave me alone. And, you know, because I thought an alcoholic was the gutter person, the person laying in the gutter. I mean, I fell down in the gutter, but I always got up. I didn't stay down. I mean, I remember actually seeing my neighbor was drunk in the gutter one time. I was like 10 years old, walking home from St. Mary's, and I said, "Bob, what's Dana? What's up with Dana?" And he's like, "Oh, he's an alcoholic." Like, "Oh, that's an alcoholic," because Mom was always calling Dad an alcoholic, and so I didn't. Well, now I was really confused. Why is Mom calling Dad an alcoholic? I've never seen Dad in the gutter before, ever. So, you know, I was really confused to know what an alcoholic was. I thought you had to have a raincoat, which I didn't own. You know, LA, it doesn't rain, didn't have a raincoat. So, you know, I thought you had to be homeless. That's what I thought an alcoholic was, but no, that's not it at all. You know, I think what makes me an alcoholic is because of what the effect it has on me. You know, I see, I know now that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent without it, but once I drink, I have that sense of ease and comfort that comes with that first drink. I didn't even need to have the drink. Just knowing if I'm going home after work and I know I'm going to drink, I felt better without even drinking yet. And so, you know, for me, and once I start, I can't stop. You know, once I have that first drink, like at my wedding, I'll just have one. No, it doesn't work for me because I have that mental obsession and the physical allergy. So, mother's telling me I'm an alcoholic and, I finally totaled my car, got fired from that Century City law firm job because I couldn't really type anymore. It was the day before, you know, days before computers. So I had to like really type the letter on real paper, I mean, with the real, you know, and I was like, oh, not working out. And so finally totaled my car. So now what I'm doing is I'm going to the bars. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, when the bars close, I call my mother. So, and we're living by LAX, and I'm still drinking in Venice with my old, the bars that I like to go to. So 2 o'clock rolls around. Hey, Mom, okay, bars closed, come get me. So she did, and I guess by the time she got there, I met a new friend, and I said, thanks for coming, Mom, but I'm going to go home with him. She's like, what? So I said, yeah, no, Teresa, no, you're coming with me. I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. And so, okay, well, I'm just going to go to the bathroom. So me and my new friend snuck out the side door, and we started walking down the Venice boardwalk, you know, Venice Beach. And I hear her, she caught on, and she's like, Teresa. I'm like, oh, geez, I got to go with her, I told my new friend. And so I left, went with mother. We got in the car, but, you know, I'm obsessed. It's one of those nights where I'm just obsessed. I just want to keep drinking. I'm not done yet. And apparently I took a bottle of beer from the bar with me. And so I'm like in a brownout, blackout. I didn't remember this. My mother told me this story on my 1 year birthday. That's how well we communicate. So this happened that night. We don't talk about it until a year ago. I mean, a year later on my 1 year birthday, we're having dinner, her and I. So anyway, this is the story. So we leave, we get in the car, we're driving home, and we're stopped at a red light on Lincoln Boulevard, Marina Del Rey. And there's the Blue Lagoon over here that I used to drink at sometimes. And sometimes they let you in after hours. And I said, thanks for coming, Mom, but I think I'm going to go see what's happening over at the Blue Lagoon Saloon. And I start to get out of the car, and she's like, no. And she grabs my pocketbook, and I'm fighting her to get away from her in the front seat of the car. I stopped at a red light on Lincoln Boulevard. And finally, the strap on my pocketbook broke, and I was able to escape. I'm like, sheesh. So I just start walking down the street with my beer and my broken pocketbook, and she threw the car in park and came after me. And now we're in the middle of the street. She took the beer out of my hands and smashed it in the street. And I'm like, oh my God, my last beer. And I was ready to fight her. I'm like, this is my last beer. And she's ready to fight me back. And I'm like, okay, we're going to fight. We're actually going to have a fist fight in the middle of Lincoln Boulevard. Now I'm 24. She's like 44, somewhere around there. And I don't know, call it my surrender, which I believe we almost come to do at some point in our lives. I call it my surrender. My brief window, my moment of clarity, my spiritual awakening, although I didn't know it at the time. And I just said, oh my God, what am I doing? This is my mother. I'm about to fist fight her in the middle of the street. And I just started crying. And so I just said, okay, let's go. And we just got in the car and we drove home. And I called my friend Alan, who at this point had 9 months of sobriety, and that was my cocaine connection. And I would see him on Venice Beach. I'm still walking around with my beer in my pot, and here's Alan. He's got 3 months of sobriety. I'm like, wow, you got 3 months of sobriety? Why? Okay. 6 months. Wow, you're 6 months clean? Why? So finally, 9 months. This all happened. He has 9 months, and I don't know who else to call. I just said, you have to come get me. My mother's driving me crazy. So he's like, all right, I'll be right there. So now it's like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. And he came and got me. And the next day he said, well, I'm going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you come? So I'm not an alcoholic. He's like, oh, okay. Why don't you come anyway? I said, all right, I'll go. I had nothing else going on. Didn't have a car. So I went, and that was that first meeting I went to in L.A. They used to meet at the Federal Building on Wilshire in West L.A., where there was that 450 people where Dr. Paul spoke, and everybody was really nice. Everybody was, like, friendly, like, here. And everybody came up and they were saying, are you new? I'm like, no, I'm with him, he's visiting. Okay, so, but these women all came up and they were giving me their phone numbers, and I'm like, thank you. I'm not sure what to do with that, but thank you. And this woman brought me up to the literature table, and there I saw the 20 questions, which I'd never seen before. They should give you those in those alcohol education classes, if you ask me. So, oh, and I remember I was going to one alcohol education thing was at this place called the Claire Foundation in L.A., and it was run by this woman named Dusty, and Dusty was an alcoholic, sober alcoholic. And I remember feeling embarrassed for her because she would get up and say, hi, everybody. We're sitting around in a circle, all those DUI people. She would say, hi, I'm Dusty. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm like, oh, my God, you said that out loud. How embarrassing, you know. So, So I'm at this meeting. So she brings me up to the literature table, and she probably showed me the big book. I don't know if I got one that night or not. And I saw the 20 questions. And I just said, thanks. I didn't read them then. I just kind of, whatever. And she just started talking to me about how she drank. And she was a heroin addict, actually. And she worked in a law firm, too, and so did I. And she was telling me about how she would go on her breaks. She would go to the ladies' room and shoot heroin on her breaks. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. I never did that. Never shot heroin, actually. Never did heroin. So that was impressive. So a few days later, I said, will you be my sponsor? Because I was so impressed. And she had 3 or 4 years of sobriety. I'm like, wow. You have 3 years? Wow. I had like 3 days at the time, I think. And for some reason, and then I read the 20 questions later. And yes, do you drink alone? Yes. You have complete memory loss? Yes. Financial difficulties? Yes. I'm working on 2 DUIs, a lot of attorney fees, a lot of court costs involved with that. So yes. And I remember sitting on the couch with my mother. Mom, look, maybe I'm an alcoholic. She's like, oh, maybe, honey. She was so kind. She didn't throw it in my face and go, I've been telling you that for 2 years. She didn't do that, What a kind and loving person. And you know what? I felt relief, It was like really early on, my two or three days in. And, I don't know why I didn't drink those days, because March 5th, 1983 was a Saturday. I don't know why I didn't drink. I remember sitting in that meeting, what am I doing here? I should be at the bar. I should be out playing pool, this is weird. So I asked Jan to be my sponsor, and for some reason, I don't know, not being convinced I was an alcoholic, but I asked her because everybody said, do you have a sponsor, and Alan was taking me to meetings every day. So I'm, geez, I guess I'm supposed to get a sponsor. So I asked her, and she said, yeah. And so she wanted me to go to 6 meetings a week. I thought, well, it's a little excessive, don't you think, Jan? No. And then she said, well, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I'm like, yeah, sure. I'm like, I had no idea what that meant. But yeah, sure. Okay. And she wanted me to get 3 commitments. And I got 3 commitments. She wanted me to say hello to 2 women I didn't know at every meeting I went to, and I said, why? And she said, are you going to do any links? Okay. But I don't really like people. People aren't really my thing. Are you willing to go to any links? All right. Okay. Oh, that's what you mean by any links. Oh, do that. Oh, okay. So for some reason, I did that, and I met one of my best friends, Vivian. And, you got to make chit-chat. You got to talk about something, I guess, if you say hi. So I'm like, how much time do you have? 12 days. Oh, I have 17 days. So, we're best friends from then on, But, it's fun to find people in your age group in the early days. So, I just started doing the deal, So the Pacific Group meets 7 days a week, but in different locations, and they have different names, But it's all on the west side. And so these people that I met, I saw every day of the week, at the same meetings, different locations of the city. And Wednesday night was the big meeting. And So the tradition there is, I don't know if you know, Clancy has a yard, and at the time, he had a pony and five or six dogs in his backyard, and he lived in Venice, 1212 Lake Street. 12 and 12, get it? So we would go there at 8:30, and I joined the softball team, because I played a little sports in school, and so I joined the softball team, was the Lake Street Blues, and we would get there at 8:30, and the people, we had to scoop all the dog crap and the pony poop, because we played volleyball later. So I had softball practice, then we'd go to the yard, have coffee, and the boys would go across the street and play softball, and the girls would stay in the yard and play volleyball. And there is where they celebrated one-year birthdays. So here comes, it's my, you know, coming up on a year, and the tradition is you get a card and a dollar for your first year. If you're five, you get a card and $5, and so on. 10 years, $10, you know, and so on. And or you get a little present. So I'm like, okay, so it's my birthday party for my 1 year, and I'm like, nobody's gonna come. You know, I have little self-worth still. All right, it's my 1 year, nobody's gonna come. But I thought, well, no, people will come because it's the yard. People go there anyway. It's not, you know, they're not coming for me. It's you're coming to do the volleyball and baseball. And then they have lunch. At noon, everybody comes back together and they have lunch, and then they have the birthday party after that. So anyway, I walked away from there with a garbage bag full of cards and little presents. And, you know, here I am thinking nobody's going to get me a card or a present, and I have all this stuff. And, you know, it really brought tears to my eyes. I'm like, oh, my gosh. And so for me, that was a monumental event. It was almost like a turning point where I need big things like that to show me that I'm going to be okay, you know? I mean, it's not that big a deal, but for me, it was a big deal. And for little by little, I got a little bit more self-esteem, you know? Little by little, I began to like myself, because up until then, I really hadn't. And so, you know, there, my sponsor had rules, like there were dating rules. If I was dating somebody, you know, it's not recommended in your first year that you date, but she did, so I could, so I did. And so she, you know, I sponsored. I was sponsored the way she was, and that's how I sponsor it. And so, you know, so when when you have that little first relationship in sobriety, you know, like when it didn't work out with the male prostitute that I was dating, I had my girlfriends to still fall back on. Well, he wasn't doing that anymore. That was the olden days. But so I could only see him 3 days a week. I still had to maintain my women friends. So in that little relationship, I use the term loosely, didn't work out. I still had my women friends to fall back on, you know, and it wasn't all about boys. And, you know, I have to be honest, that was an attraction when I got sober. My first meeting, I was like, wow, there's a lot of cute boys here compared to the bars I was drinking in Venice, you know, and everybody's clean looking. So that was an attraction, you know. And I remember telling my sponsor, the only reason I'm going to this meeting on Sunday is because so-and-so's there, this boy that I like is going to be there. She's like, that's okay, whatever gets you there. I'm like, really? Okay. So, you know, it wasn't like all serious all the time, you know what I mean? I had a lot of fun. We went river rafting. We went, you know, we went places as a group in sobriety. And I remember telling my father that, Dad, I'm sober and I'm in this group and we do everything together. It's like a community in a community. All my friends are sober and we're, you know, I do everything at weddings and birthday parties and everything. It's just so awesome. He's like, oh, geez, just don't drink the Kool-Aid. I'm like, okay. Because he thought it was some kind of cult thing. So, you know, I got to do the steps. I got to make amends, you know. All those cousins that I got arrested, I got to make amends to my aunts for that. We were at my brother's wedding, actually, some years later, and I said, hey, Auntie Ann, remember that time we all got arrested with David and Michael and... Yes, I remember. Like, oh, well, you know, I need to make amends to you. And, you know, and whenever I made amends to my father. I used to steal money out of my father's wallet, you know. I wasn't a very nice person. I used to steal my brother's dope out of his school bag, you know. Like, we'd steal that cough syrup after school and at the drugstore. We used to eat packs of Dramamine. And, you know, I used to steal that from him. And I'd pinch pot out of his bag and put oregano in it. And... You know, and then I would drink half of his cough syrup and fill it up with water, and he would wonder why he didn't get stoned. So, you know, just all, I mean, stuff like that. I made amends to these people, and I just remember making amends to my father, and it was always like, well, yeah, me too. He would say, me too. If I've ever done anything that harmed you, then I'm sorry too. And, you know, and I remember my father visiting, and, you know, I have this little house in Santa Barbara. My brother had a little house in L.A. I just remember my father visiting, and I'm all, not bad for a couple of drunks, huh, Dad? And he goes, yeah, not bad. He goes, I didn't think you guys were going to make it. And so, again, no communication. No, he never said that. He never communicated to me, Tree, you're drinking a little too much, don't you think? And I'm like, he never said that. And I'm like, what do you mean? You thought I drank a lot? You never said. And, you know, here's my father, who's a daily drinker, thinking that I drink too much, you know? So, anyway, he was impressed, and then, and he never said so until that day, and it was just kind of, you know. And he would come to meetings with us. We would come to meetings with my brother and I, and he would always stand up as a visitor, and he admitted he was an alcoholic, and he would never drink when he came and visited us, and he would do pills, I guess. But, so I'm at the yard one time, and I saw him across the yard. It was Boy Meets Girl on AA campus. It was really like a campus. It was Clancy's yard. And, he happened to be from Santa Barbara. So anyway, we started this long-distance relationship. And we got married a year later. And we were married for many years, 24 years or something like that. And we ended up getting separated in 2010. We got married in 86, separated in 2010. And it was like, wow. Oh, and we had a couple kids. And it was good when he left, because I'm like, it was kind of a weird thing. He would leave and come back. So this was the third time, I think, we were on a break. They were just taking another break. Good, I need one. So I'm like, he's like, I'm leaving. I got an apartment, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, okay, do you need help packing? Like, good, geez. And so he's like, no, I'm good. I was like, okay, see ya. And then it was, I felt like I got let out of prison. And so that's, can give you an idea of how the marriage was. And my kids are like, wow, I haven't seen you this happy in years. You look great. And blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, this is great. It's so much fun. But then he got a girlfriend. I'm like, what? Then it's kind of like, oh my God, this is, what? Is this really happening? Are we really getting a divorce? I thought we were just taking a break. Even though I said, if you leave again, don't come back. But anyway, that was that. And he started dating in 2012, we did get back together briefly, and I was like, it wasn't working. So, it was really, really traumatic, to be with somebody for 25, 26 years, whatever it was. Just everything about my life changed, and it was really, really hard. And I was suicidal, actually, and I own a firearm, and my sponsor wanted to come over and take my gun. I'm like, no, I'm good. I'm good. And my son at the time had moved out. He was my youngest. He moved out and got his own apartment. And he would stop over my house every single day. And he would just hold me and I would just cry. And I was like, I don't want to be divorced. As bad as it was, I didn't, that was my identity, you know what I mean? And as bad as the marriage was, I'm like, what am I going to do by myself? What am I going to do? And I was just so, so suicidal. And I really just wanted to kill myself. But I didn't? Because our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And I thought of my son. It doesn't have to be an alcoholic person you're thinking of, but you think of others and how you may help meet their needs. It doesn't necessarily have to be an alcoholic. In this case, it was my son, because he would have been the one to find me since he stopped over every morning before he went to work. And I couldn't have that. I was thinking of somebody else besides myself. And I couldn't do that to him, because what kind of memory would that be for your kid, I remember when my first daughter was born, I thought, oh, yay, it's a girl. And my second thought was, oh, my poor mother, because at that time I realized the unconditional love that a parent has for their kid. And I couldn't do that to my son. And so anyway, that saved me. Also in chapter 7, I think it is working with others. Where it talks about practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. And that works when all their activities fail. You know, it's always about somebody else. When all else fails, I do the 12 step. And, I try to think sometimes, what's the most important thing in AA? What is that most critical step? What's the most important thing that I do? Is it the meetings? Is it the fellowship? Is it step one? Is it admitting you're an alcoholic? Is it step three, turning my will and my life over to the care of God? Is it step 12? Is it getting commitments? Is it getting 6 commitments a week? Well, you know what? I've come to the conclusion that it's all of it. It's all of it. It's the program. You know, I've been able to learn. I've picked up the simple set of spiritual tools that were laid at my feet. And I'm able to pick those up and use those tools today. And, you know, today that my husband and I are good friends. I sat with him yesterday up at the hospital, or at the hospice, with where his mother's, you know, passing away probably, and we got to talk. And it's not like there's any animosity, you know, we're friends, and that's just the healing process from Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think that would happen. I know my daughter's in-laws, they're divorced, and they don't talk at all. They'll be in the same room. They came to my daughter's wedding last year. They don't even say hello to each other, you know? So, and they're not, you know, they don't have the tools that we have. So you know, it's just, it's really a privilege. I used to do some H&I work, and it's a privilege to be able to participate. And why it's a privilege is when Bill Wilson got sober, he asked the doctor for the privilege to go and share with the alcoholics in the hospital. And, you know, it's just kind of amazing how this all came about. And, the third step, I never knew the third step until, like, 2012. And, where it says, relieve me from the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them will bear witness to those that I would help. And I thought, you know, when I was going through that divorce, I did that third step prayer all the time. I was reading all kinds of spiritual books, you know, and I just, you know, God, are you putting this difficulty in my life so I get closer to you? And that always happens to me. I pray more. Whenever the shit hits the fan, I pray more. Yeah. I got all these spiritual books going. I up my meetings. I work with more people, you know, and it becomes a better program. But, you know, and I want to know why. Why is this happening to me? Well, why not? I remember in 2010, I was in San Antonio for the International Convention, and I saw Clancy. He goes, hey, Teresa, how's it going? I'm all, I'm not so good. I'm getting a divorce. I'm all crying. So, get away. And I'm, get away. There are worse things than that. I'm like, no, there isn't. No, we're like, what? You know, I'm thinking to myself, and I'm grabbing his coattails, but no, wait. And he's like, get away. So, but you know, I thought there was a lot worse things, you know, but when you're in it, you can't really see it. But no matter what's happening in your life, somebody always has it worse. You know, I remember at the time my friend Pam's granddaughter was in the same hospice where my mother-in-law is, and she's like 18 years old and she's dying of cancer. You know, 18 years old. And imagine that. I mean, yeah, God, there are worse things. And, there was just like this blackness. I mean, it was just black. And, you know, I'd pray, like I say, I'm praying. You know, but faith without works is dead. So I'm like, okay, I got to follow this prayer up with some action. So I'm doing the action, I'm doing the deal. And little by little, the black turns to gray. You know, the gray is kind of still fuzzy. I still got kind of a gray veil on. But that starts to leave. Pretty soon it's brighter. Then one day it's light. One day I see the light. And I think, Jesus, I would have killed myself over a guy. How stupid would that be? You know, because life is so good today. My life is, I mean, I gotta tell you, my life is the best it's ever been in my life. You know, I mean, you hear people say that, but this is the first time I think that I can actually say that and really mean it, that my life is better than, I mean, my life is so good today. If it were any better, I think I was dreaming. You know, and I just don't leave if you knew. Don't leave before the miracle happens. It's gonna happen. You just got to stay and wait that stuff out. It's not going to stay bad forever. It's not going to stay good forever, but it's not going to stay bad forever. You know, it's up and down. It's peaks and valleys. And, you know, my kids are non-alcoholic. I don't know why. I mean, you know, 50-50 chance they're going to be, because my husband or husband's an alcoholic, and like, I didn't care. I want kids, so it's the risk I was willing to take. But they're both good. They're seemingly normal. You know, my son, question mark. But he knows where to go. AA is here for them, you know? And I don't know. I'm just, life is just so good. And, you know, to think that I could have missed it all because of a stupid relationship. And, you know, like I said, when you're in it, it's really bad. But once you're past it, and my friends would say, Tree, you're going to get over this. I'm like, really, when? You know, when is it going to, you know, but it will and it does. And, you know, and so I thought, okay, so step three there, relieve me from bondage so that I can be an example for others. I thought, okay, God, if you're using me for an example, I'm going to try to walk through this with as much dignity and grace as I can. And that's what I tried to do. And, you know, because when I say it can always be worse, I know somebody, a friend, my former sponsor in L.A., she was married, had a new baby, and her husband was sleeping with a newcomer and got her pregnant. I was like, oh, yes, it could be worse. It could be a lot worse. So anyway, I think I'm kind of done. But thank you so much, everybody, for being here and for listening. And if you're new, I hope you stay. Thank you.
Let's give Teresa another round of applause.